But if you use a global warming potential of 100 years, then the control clouds might be a little bit under the climate impact of carbon emissions. If you use a GWP of 20, then they could be almost double. The reality is they affect the relative balance of the Earth. On average, they cause the surface warming effect. The warming is of the same order of magnitude as carbon emissions. Any airline claiming to want to get to net zero climate impact will have to address this.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. This season of Sustainability in the Air is brought to you by Travelport. Travelport is a global technology firm that powers bookings for hundreds of thousands of travel suppliers worldwide. The company's travel retailing marketplace, Travelport Plus, helps retailers understand and communicate the most sustainable options. When it comes to sustainability in travel, it can be difficult for travelers and agents to identify which flights, routes, and accommodations are the greenest. That's why Travelport empowers its agents to operate as modern retailers of sustainable travel, giving them the ability to access consistent emissions data using the Travel Impact Model. Travelport is also exploring solutions to help travel retailers offer carbon compensation and nature regeneration to their customers. What if there was an innovation that could dramatically reduce the warming caused by aviation using current available technology? My guest today, Adam Durant, is the CEO and founder of Satavia, which does contrail management, or these are those aircraft-generated condensation trails that can sometimes contribute to over 60% of aviation's climate impact. Adam and his company Satavia help airlines predict when these will be happening and then reduce them using today's technology. You don't have to wait 10 years or 15 years to develop a new type of aircraft. You can start reducing them today. Adam and his company has already worked with the likes of Etihad Airways, the likes of KLM, and have shown promising results. I deep dive with Adam and we geek out exactly what contrails are, how they can be reduced, and why we need to look beyond carbon footprint of aviation to look at non-CO2 impact as well. Adam, it's great to be speaking once again about all of the groundbreaking work you have been doing in terms of contrail reduction. Now, this is not a new science, but it's definitely new to many airlines around the world. Can you tell us why it is important to look beyond carbon emissions when it comes to overall airline emissions, and where do contrails play a part?
Well, thanks. Yeah, delighted to be on the podcast. So we've known about clouds that aircraft make for as long as aircraft have been flying. Some of the earliest contrails that were observed formed on Lancaster bombers going across the channel during the war. There's wonderful pictures of hundreds of these aircraft making contrail clouds. We know that clouds affect the radiative balance of the Earth, so they affect sunlight coming in and heat trying to escape. We're pretty confident after nearly a century of science that we can model this and we understand how clouds form. It has taken, however, the aviation industry quite some time to start recognizing that there's a climate impact coming from not only the carbon emissions, which is widely accepted, but also from the clouds that the aircraft make, plus other species like NOx, which are nitrous oxides, and soot. Yeah, it's really encouraging now that the industry is starting to formally recognize this. We're seeing regulation being formed in the EU right now, which means that aviation actually has an outsized climate impact coming from things that are not carbon.
You are on a mission to remove the very thing that many kids find very beautiful, these contrails flying overhead. You want clean skies, wiped clean, and that's because these contrails have a warming effect.
Not all contrails have a warming effect, but we would like to see certain contrails removed. So those are contrails that cause us on net warming effect. Some contrails actually cause a cooling effect. There is an argument that if we get good enough at avoiding the long-lived contrails that create a warming effect, well, we should probably leave the contrail clouds that create a cooling effect, or maybe even route aircraft places to make cooling contrail clouds until such a time as we have achieved decarbonization of our industries and economies.
Adam, you are a scientist. Can you explain it like you would explain it to my daughter or your kid, who are, I think, the same age, on how this works? Why are contrails bad for the climate?
So everyone's seen these streaks across the sky, these contrail clouds. They're called condensation trails. They are basically clouds full of ice crystals. The atmosphere is full of water, and in some places there's enough water to cause clouds to form. And clouds may be formed of very small liquid droplets where the temperatures are warmer, but where aircraft fly, the temperatures are very cold, typically minus 50, minus 60. So water vapor in the atmosphere forms very small ice crystals. They might be only 1 to 10 microns in size. Usually the clouds where aircraft fly are called cirrus. And these ice crystals interact with sunlight coming in, but they also interact with heat that's trying to escape to space. During the nighttime, of course, there's no sunlight, so the clouds act as a thermal blanket. And during the daytime, they can interact with sunlight, reflect it back to space, and that actually prevents some of the energy reaching the surface where it warms up. So an aircraft flying through the atmosphere, burning kerosene, will emit carbon dioxide, but also nitrous oxides and water. And in parts of the atmosphere where there's lots of water vapor, so it's saturated or even supersaturated, the clouds are ready to form. The aircraft passing through creates turbulence, and it also emits more water from the engines when you burn kerosene. And that additional water and all that turbulent energy can form cirrus, contrail. And so what it means is, we're forming clouds in places of the atmosphere that may naturally have formed clouds, but we've effectively triggered the cloud formation early by adding extra water and stirring up the atmosphere with the turbulence from the aircraft. Some of these clouds can persist for many hours. If they stay in a part of the atmosphere that's full of water and the water stays in high concentration, so we have a very high relative humidity, then some of these contrail clouds can last for hours or tens of hours. So it's only 5% actually of all flights that create these very long-lived warming contrails. And typically at night time, you get a very large warming effect from these what's called persistent contrails. So really the solution we're trying to achieve is to be able to forecast where the water is in the atmosphere, forecast what's called ice supersaturated regions. So this is where the water vapor is over 100% relative humidity, but it's ready to make clouds, or just around about 100% relative humidity. And then you add extra water in from the aircraft. So we want to find places to put the aircraft where it's not going to create those clouds. Once you reroute the aircraft, then of course the cloud doesn't form and you don't have that warming effect. So that's what we're aiming for.
That is very well explained. Thank you for being very crystal clear on how this is happening. I was recently at a forum hosted by Boeing where an MIT engineer or a scientist who's been working with Delta was talking about contrails as well. And he said that the science has been debatable for a long time, and we are now trying to prove that this exists. What is the debate? Because I've actually heard this from a few airlines as well. Oh, contrails are debatable. We are waiting for scientists to prove this. It seems from what you're explaining, this is clear cut. There are ice crystals that are reflecting sunlight back on Earth, hence it warms the planet. So what is debatable about this?
In my opinion, the the challenge has been around trying to put an absolute number on what is the total annual warming effect from these contrail clouds, or even just is it a warming effect or is it a cooling effect? So the latest IPCC report actually put forward some estimates. And of course, there's uncertainties about how those calculations are done. The uncertainties propagate when you try and do this over all flights for 365 days of the year. So that results in some large numbers in terms of CO2 equivalent forcing with large ranges. So it is true that there is uncertainty on the range of estimates for what is the total annual climate impact from aircraft contrails. However, I would say if you go to shorter timescales, so if you look at an individual flight, you take state-of-the-art and numerical weather prediction, which is what we use, with a model that's been highly validated for its ability to predict water vapor, then the errors, the corresponding errors on the model forecasting that's required to do contrail management or assessment of contrail climate impact are quite small on a per-flight basis. In fact, they're probably within measurement error. So my position would be that the atmospheric science, the cloud microphysics, has existed for many decades. Some of the challenges have been around, can we predict water vapor in the atmosphere well enough using a forecast model? And there still remains challenges around trying to scale that up to an annual estimate of what is aviation's contrail climate impact. And there's still some also debate around which climate metric to use. So my position is, I think the science exists. I think the models, weather models, are good enough now to do contrail management. And I still think we need to do some more work on getting to that overall annual assessment. But that is, you know, work that's done by the likes of the IPCC and all the groups that contribute to that.
Fair enough. So it is the aggregates that we are debating, but certain individual efforts have been done. In fact, you have done run a very successful pilot with Etihad Airways in the United Arab Emirates. Tell us about how you landed that pilot and what exactly was done.
Great. So the history of this actually is we started working in 2018 on a different problem, but related. This is being able to analyze and predict conditions that lead to very small ice crystals in the atmosphere. So it's called ice crystal icing conditions. These can present hazards to aviation, so it can affect the ability of an aircraft to do airspeed measurement errors. So Air France 2009 was an example of where an aircraft passed into a cloud of very small ice crystals and you got pitot tube icing. There's also problems presented to engines. So compressors can ice up, so you get core icing. And this has happened hundreds of times, actually, where aircraft have flown into higher level ice clouds and the compressors have iced up and they've lost power. And that can also lead to damage done to the turbine section. So initially we were working on this problem. We won funding from the Aerospace Technology Institute in the UK to work alongside Rolls-Royce, GKN Aerospace and University of Oxford. We spent several years starting with, if you like, off-the-shelf numerical weather prediction model capability. So we use the American Wharf model. In my team, I have one of the actual core model developers, a guy called Dr. Greg Thompson. So he's an expert in cloud microphysics. He's written one of the microphysics schemes in that model. And then we set about validating the microphysics and actually making improvements to it through that three-year engagement we did funded by the ATI. So by the time we get to 2020 and 2021, we've actually advanced the skill of a weather model to do high-level analysis of ice clouds. We validated its skill to do, you know, 24, 48-hour predictions into the future. We can run it as a hindcast. And we know really well the performance of this model, and we've compared it against other off-the-shelf data. And so it's performing much better. Critically, that led us, you know, with the timing of the release of the latest IPCC report, they indicate that contrails are a problem. So it's important to note that while there is a large range in how big is the problem, it's as big as CO2. It could be twice as big. So, you know, that's really all we need to know. So we then just focused our attention on to looking for the conditions that lead to these persistent, long-lived warming contrails using the capability we developed actually to predict when you get conditions that lead to high-level ice clouds. So it's the same microphysics. We'd already spent years validating a model. We were there with the validated technology when this issue really started to come to the fore. And we, through COVID, we shifted all of our attention onto this issue. We engaged initially with Emirates Airlines through the Aviation X Lab, which is an incubator based in Dubai. And that's got the backing of Airbus, Thales, GE, Collins, and Emirates Airline. And we did some of the first flight planning with Emirates Airline. And then that led us actually to engage with Etihad. And so we actually did the first flights that did contrail management based on the predictions from our weather model, alongside Boeing and GE and others, as part of the Etihad Greenliner, or the Eco Demonstrator program run by Boeing. So that was what led us then to engaging with Etihad for a 12-month POC in 2022. And so we did flight planning with them every week, analyzed their entire schedule and targeted those sort of long-lived flights producing long-lived warming contrails. And so we learned a lot about how to do it, how to optimize the process, the limitations are. And that's where we find ourselves today. We're starting to engage more widely across the industry, backing from the European Space Agency. So we're kind of ready now to start really bringing this into day-to-day flight operations.
This is very interesting how, you know, everything came together in an incubator or an accelerator, and Etihad was a part of it. Since then, you have scaled up. You've done that Sharm el-Sheikh flight, or rather, it was a flight for COP27, I believe, where Etihad flew from Washington, D.C. to Abu Dhabi. What was done there? And were you able to solve the issue you mentioned earlier, differentiating the contrails that cause cooling effect versus the heating effect? How are you able to scale and apply this?
Yeah, so it's challenging. It's a challenging problem to solve. So every day is different. It depends on the weather on the day. It's affected by season. It depends where the flights are geographically. So, you know, desert regions typically are a lot drier. High latitude regions are colder and wetter. And there's seasonality superimposed on that. Most of the flying is done in Europe and North America. So then you've got, where do you find aircraft? It's superimposed on seasonality and climatology. So every day is different, is what it boils down to. And as long as you can forecast weather accurately and specifically water vapor, then we can link that to airline schedules and the flight plans made by the airlines. So the process we've developed is, on the day that we're doing contrail management, we schedule our weather model to run. So it usually runs during the night. So it takes a few hours. It runs on a supercomputer. We work closely with both AWS and Microsoft. So we've built our capability in the commercial cloud infrastructure that provides scalability and security. So we run the weather model. We have the weather data available before the airline even starts their flight planning. We've coupled a model that was developed by the German Aerospace Center, DLR, it's called COSIP, to our weather model, created a data pipeline that allows us then to analyze individual flight plans done by the airline. We start off by going through their entire schedule and targeting the 5% of flights on the day, which create about 80% of that warming effect. So we can go through every single flight number based on where they've planned their flights over the last few weeks. We can then start making assessments as to which flights are likely to create the long-lived warming contrails. And we find it's a handful of flights each day for a medium-sized operator like Etihad, which actually we need to focus on to solve most of the problem. So then the airline goes about planning their flights as they normally would. And we work then closely with dispatchers to help them to simply change flight levels that the airline is planning to fly at on certain routes. We don't change the whole flight plan. We're very focused on maybe a small number of waypoints where you might need to make some small adjustments, a few thousand feet up or down, just to avoid these moist layers. The whole process might take 5 to 15 minutes per flight, depending how long it is, and create a new flight plan, verify that's actually better than the original situation, and then that's given to the pilot. So from the pilot's perspective, there's nothing new. They're just following a flight plan. They have a briefing pack that goes alongside that that gives them information about contrail formation. And that's really the process. The pilot executes the flight plan. Critically, we go back about a week later. We rerun our weather model in hindcast mode. So we create what's called a weather analysis product. So this now is best available weather data constrained by observation that's coming from satellites, ground-based measurements and in-situ measurements from radios on balloons. It's a whole division of science called data assimilation that creates the data sets then that are used to drive models in hindcast. We go back and look at the original flight plan, analyze both the CO2, non-CO2 impacts, we look at the flown trajectory, and we expect to see a reduction in overall climate impact. And we can express that in CO2 equivalent units. And so that is what we do for every flight we change. We're tracking KPIs all the time. That's the nature of the European Space Agency funding we've got. And we're collaborating closely with academic organizations and others doing contrail management to improve both the process and the science as we go.
Wow, that is incredibly detailed. Thank you. I have a renewed understanding now of how this is working. You mentioned just a handful of flights every single day after the entire analysis needs to be changed. So let's say this is a flight that goes from Abu Dhabi to Paris in Etihad's case, or Abu Dhabi to Amsterdam. And there are certain flight levels which are changed. Once you have nailed this flight for a particular day or a particular week, can this not be repeated rather than doing the analysis all over again every single time? Can this not be repeated for that same week every year or same day every month or based on seasonality? Is there some repeatability here?
Every day is unique with respect to both the weather, but also with respect to the flight plan. The airline almost never will fly exactly the same flight plan. And that is dependent on things like the weather, the winds. It might be affected by geopolitical situations, what airspace is available, but also the aircraft type and how heavy it is and how old it is. So that will, the performance of the aircraft determines ultimately what the flight plan shall be. So we can get some sort of generalized statistics on routes and season as to likelihood of having warming contrails, but every day is unique, so we have to do this for every single flight.
Wow, this sounds like a lot of work. You, of course, have now received European Space Agency funding, which is also linked to the UK Space Agency, which will help you scale to the larger aviation sector. How are you planning to do that, given this is so much work?
Absolutely. So we get our economies of scale through the software that we've built. So we automate as much as possible. We make it as simple as possible to deliver our product. And we've spent many years building the software to do that. So that's a starting point. The European Space Agency funding comes from a program called ARTES, which is part of their business applications program, which essentially provides support to enable us to engage with, in our case, airlines to do demonstration. So this is almost like a door opener. So we've had lots of inbound interest. Every week we're running our POC with KLM and KLM Cityhopper, but alongside that we're working with other airlines to do one-off demos with support from the European Space Agency. So that enables us also to assess the overall success of doing contrail management. So that is a combination of, is the model performing? Is the weather model performing as we expect it to? How is the process going that we've developed with the dispatchers and the airline? So quite often we can't do a flight that we want to change because of performance or because of just availability of people to do that flight plan optimization. But there's always wins that we can make, and sometimes we're restricted by air traffic management. In fact, that is going to become the bottleneck to scaling this, especially in busy places like Europe. So the sooner we can move to a more dynamic way of managing air traffic, the better, really, because every day, as I said, is unique. And so depending on where the frontal systems are and the water is, we're going to try, in as much as possible, avoid putting aircraft through these ice supersaturated regions. And it's going to affect all operators equally. And so everyone's going to want to get to the same bit of airspace to avoid making those contrail clouds. So I would say that's an issue we really should be talking about sooner than later, because it will take some time to solve that issue.
Well, I'm glad that you're working with more airlines now, and you have the ESA UK Space Agency funding, because that will allow you to test this with more airlines over multiple routes, and hopefully, your software performs even better with all of this data put in it. Now, one of the things I learned recently, I spoke with the head of sustainability for Delta Airlines, and Pam shared that Delta is collaborating with MIT in developing an open source model for contrail management, whereas Satavia, of course, is a private company. What is different in these approaches, and what's better?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So there's some code that's been open sourced. Actually, it's been open sourced by collaboration between Imperial College London, DLR, and Breakthrough Energy Sciences. So that is, in fact, the same model that we use. It's called COSIP, and it enables anybody running the code to assess how contrails formed on a given flight will affect surface energy. So will it be warming? Will it be cooling? So there is this open source tool now that's been developed that's widely available. However, it does require still good water vapor data in, and currently off the shelf data are not particularly accurate, which is also why some people have challenged the science. Google and MIT have co-developed a slightly different approach that predominantly utilizes some very excellent algorithms that have been developed to process satellite data to identify contrails and satellite imagery. So that's been done by the MIT group, and that's been combined with Google's sort of deep learning capabilities to then be able to analyze, forecast locations where we find highly observable large contrail clouds forming. So Delta and others have been working with MIT on this. In fact, last week, as part of the Sustainable Flight Challenge of SkyTeam, both ourselves and MIT worked with Delta and KLM on a flight. And in fact, we found that our approaches are, in reality, quite complementary. So our approach enables pre-tactical planning, in such that an airline can already make decisions to avoid forming warming contrails on certain flights before the aircraft even departs. So that means you can get the fuel loadings right. You already understand how you're going to do the maneuvers. The MIT approach requires observations of contrail clouds, and that's actually a very good tactical tool. So once an aircraft is airborne, you get best available observational data, actually clearly indicating where the clouds are, combined with some four-dimensional modeling, gives you some estimate of the flight levels to try and avoid. And so the two could go hand in hand, where you have a certain amount being done pre-tactical, and then verification in flight, and possibly tactical maneuvers done as observations are available. So we're very excited about, where the technologies could go. Very open to collaboration. The reason we're doing this commercially primarily is because aviation is a for-profit industry, and it's incredibly difficult to, in this highly regulated industry as well, to try and disrupt the way things are done without having a really strong financial incentive there to do it or regulation. So our approach, actually, we have a patented method to create credits for the operators. So we're trying to create an incentive, a carrot, for airlines to do this, which comes at some cost, but we give them credits back ultimately to cover the cost of doing that and to incentivize them to do it. Now, if we don't take this approach and we wait for regulation, which is coming in Europe and could be with us in the second half of this decade with financial penalties, well, that also will change behaviors. It'll be more of a reluctant change of behavior, and it will add to costs of flying. So that'll feed back into everything that we need. It's not just people that travel, it's also freight, and an important part of the economy.
Right. Okay. I'm glad to hear it's complementary and not competitive, by the way. And, you know, both of you together will definitely help the entire ecosystem. As you now speak with multiple airlines and, I guess, multiple airline CEOs, multiple airline heads of sustainabilities, what is the number one roadblock that you tend to hit, or what is the number one objection that you often hear?
So we often hear comments about the science. And so a lot of what we do is starts off with, you know, trying to present what we do in a way that is understandable, and also how we've, you know, resolved some of the issues. But I think primarily it's about the airline having budget to do this ahead of any regulation. It certainly has helped that the EU ETS in April put out a tender to design the monitoring, reporting and verification system for aviation's non-CO2, which will include contrails, and that will be enforced by 2025. So that's actually now starting to produce a need for them to start investing in this. But they have already committed huge budgets to sustainable aviation fuel, which doesn't exist today at scale. And a lot of what's been done, in my opinion, serves marketing more than anything. It's going to have almost no measurable impact on reducing aviation emissions today. There's just not enough sustainable aviation fuel available. However, airlines are investing tens or even hundreds of millions into sustainable aviation fuels today, whereas we could solve this problem for the whole of the industry with that level of funding that a single airline may be putting into sustainable aviation fuel. So my, you know, ask of airline CEOs would be, help us get this solution to the next stage. We don't need anything like the amount of resource that's required to scale sustainable aviation fuel, and we can deliver the results in a single digit number of years and potentially solve the majority of aviation's climate impact, depending on how you measure it.
So you're saying that non-CO2 emissions can be up to 50%, if not even more than that?
Like I say, it depends how you measure that, which climate metric you use. But if you use a global warming potential of 100 years, then the contrail clouds might be a little bit under the climate impact of carbon emissions. If you use a GWP of 20, then they could be almost double. The reality is they affect the relative balance of the Earth. On average, they cause a surface warming effect. The warming is of the same order of magnitude as carbon emissions. Any airline claiming to want to get to net zero climate impact will have to address this. And that should be a big part of the motivation.
And I think just like operational efficiencies, this is something that can be done right away. It can be achieved right now with today's technologies. And I think the approach you have adopted with Etihad or KLM is the right one, which is, let's do a few pilots, let's see what the results are, and let's scale from there. So I find it quite encouraging to see more and more airlines working with you and the likes of MIT as well, to be honest, to address their impact from contrails.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're at an exciting time where aviation faced with few technological options, really, to address climate impact. This is one thing the industry could do quickly and have a really tangible, positive outcome.
Adam, we spoke about the importance of getting a gold standard verification for Satavia. You've just gotten that. What does this mean for the company? What does this actually mean?
Yeah, this is a big step forward for us. We're not through the whole process yet, and we've been going for nearly 2 years in the gold standards process, but they have approved our method concept for creation of credits for doing contrail mitigation. And this means that there's still several steps that we have to go through of intense review done by external expert reviewers. There's also a public consultation that will take place. But we're hoping to have done all of that and be in a position fully accredited where we can create credits for operators who do contrail management as soon as the end of this year or maybe early 2024. So the decision is really, it's quite a milestone because it gives us sort of a clear intent that there's going to be rigorous review of the method. And should all of that check out, then we will have a method to create these credits. And that will be an incentive for operators. So it's really about creating an incentive for aircraft operators to do this today.
Right. So what is the incentive? So let's say I know you're working with Etihad, for example, or KLM City Hopper. What does this mean when you say they can use this as a carbon credit? What does it essentially mean?
So there's a cost involved in doing contrail management today, and it comes in many forms. It's time. It takes extra time to, in our case, replan existing flights to remove the contrail impact in the case of warming contrail flights. So that translates for the operator into person time. So we need a dispatcher to do some extra flight planning. And then there's the involvement of the flight ops and the pilots. Not so much extra work for the pilots, but all of this adds overhead. And then sometimes we need to fly at slightly lower or higher flight levels than the optimal flight level. And in our trials, this translates on average into a fuel penalty of 0.1%. So there was some press this week where Google have been doing this with American Airlines and they had a 2% fuel penalty. We're at 0.1%. But that still comes with a cost. So there's both the additional time and then there's the cost of any fuel. But the benefit of doing that, of course, is many orders of magnitude greater than the CO2 penalties created. And then there's the whole concept of additionality. That's why this method is being put forward. So there's no regulation today that says an airline has to modify its flying behavior to prevent the warming contrail clouds that have an impact on climate. So you can do two things. You can create an incentive that gives them a reward, a financial reward for doing it, so that compensates for any costs, or you can create regulation. If you have regulation that says they have to do contrail management, then there's no case really for doing a voluntary project to create credit for doing it. So we're at the stage where there's no regulation, they don't have to do it. We want to create an incentive. We want to compensate for any penalties in terms of time and cost for doing it. And so that sort of leads us to make the argument that it makes sense to offer credits proportional to the climate impact that we've prevented. And so that's the whole process we go through post-flight of analyzing what would have happened, which becomes the baseline, had they flown the original flight plan. So that's basically designed to minimize fuel burn. It's designed to maintain the schedule. And then the modified flight plan and flight trajectory that doesn't make those clouds. So we go in afterwards and verify actually that the outcome was better and we can calculate the radiative impact that we've prevented. And then we can convert that to a CO2 equivalent tonnage using a very well-known climate metric called global warming potential. And that is essentially the method that we've put forward for accreditation that would enable us then to create tradable units for aircraft operators to act as an incentive to actually take some action on the issue.
Does this mean that airlines can then offset the cost of using Satavia or doing contrail avoidance by any means?
Yeah, that's the intent. So the credits actually then have some value. So these can be traded under the voluntary carbon market. And that means then there's a clear financial incentive for them. So they take a share of the credits and that becomes then a clear reason for doing this, because actually it means we can offer this service at no cost. When the finance department looks at the cost of doing this, they find out actually this is going to be, you know, this is not going to add cost. It could actually be cost negative, but it's doing good for climate. But it's really important, you know, there's lots of rules that are going to be put around the creation and use of these credits in our method. The first is the airline has to recognize, first of all, the additional climate impacts at a non-CO2 part. So depending on how you measure it, that could add somewhere between, it could be about 35% to over 50% of the overall impact. Secondly, we're not creating credits that are equivalent to offsets. These are not offsets. You can't interchange between credits, verified emission reduction credits, and the certified mitigation units that we're creating with Gold Standard. They're completely independent, non-fungible, and our credits are linked directly to actions taken by aircraft operators, and they stay within the aviation value chain. So it's limited distribution, but trading between stakeholders in aviation. So for example, if a big operator outside of the European Union decided to do contrail management and created credits, those could be offered to a European operator who's not doing it. And then ultimately, if we can get this recognized under CORSIA and or the EU ETS, then that would be a mechanism for that European operator to make claim to helping to reduce the overall impact of aviation's impact on climate.
Fantastic. So it's actually like a tradable carbon credit. It's not just for those who can actually do it. It's a bit like book and claim for SAF, as it's become right now.
So that's a very interesting observation there. So we are looking at exactly that. So incentivizing an operator simultaneously to decarbonize and buy sustainable aviation fuel and also do contrail management. And so there's credits in both cases. The ideal solution to the problem of getting aviation to net zero is to have both of those tackled at the same time.
This is really good progress, Adam. As you know, there are other models coming up as well. So for example, Google AI is doing its own contrail management. How is your model different, and is the rise of competition good for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that we have a number of different approaches to addressing the contrail issue. So our approach relies on numerical weather prediction modeling. We focus on making our water vapor predictions highly accurate, and then we link that to the flight planning done by the airlines. So we help them target flights to modify, and we can actually discriminate between flights that create contrails that are warming or cooling, and we can determine which flights on a given day will produce the really long-lived warming contrails. So the key thing here is only 5% of all flights create about 80% of the warming problem from contrails. Every day is different, depends where the weather is. So you need to be quite targeted. You shouldn't change all flights. Some contrail clads are okay, you can leave them. So contrasting with our approach is the recently announced Google approach. So they analyze satellite data. They look for linear cloud features in satellite imagery. And so then they can identify those as contrail clouds. And then they use machine learning both to do the identification, but then also to predict where those clouds are likely to go. And they can identify parts of airspace which lead to the formation of these contrail clouds. So one of the, I guess, benefits of this approach is that it's observation based. I guess one of the slight challenges with the approach is that you need to make contrails to avoid contrails. So you can never truly avoid making all contrails with this approach. So I think, in fact, our two approaches could be quite complementary. We help with pre-tactical decision making. We can help to change flight plans. And then once the aircraft are airborne, Google's approach could actually verify that we've made the right decisions before the aircraft leaves. We're no longer making contrails. Or if we are making contrails, those pilots could be alerted to change flight levels. So a tactical solution. So, that's how I see this evolving.
Yeah, I see lots of different pieces of the puzzle fitting here together. I've also had a lot of hydrogen believers on the podcast. I had Val Miftikoff, I had Paul Ermenko. And my question is, as hydrogen technology and hydrogen-powered aircraft come into play, will your technology still be relevant? Will they produce contrails? And will your software help them avoid it?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thought and point. So certainly, moving to hydrogen is a possible solution for decarbonizing aviation, so you can remove the CO2 emissions. That's assuming you don't create any CO2 emissions in the creation of hydrogen. Of course, hydrogen's a leaky gas as well, and it's a greenhouse gas. So we have to address all those issues. But if you were to burn hydrogen, or if you were to use it in a fuel cell, you still emit water. In fact, you emit more water by combusting hydrogen on a mass basis than you do from kerosene. So hydrogen propulsion is going to emit more water than is emitted by aircraft today on the same sort of size aircraft. There are lots of particles in the atmosphere, dust, other aerosols that can help form ice crystals in the atmosphere. So it follows if you emit more water through hydrogen propulsion, you are going to potentially create more prevalent contrail clouds. That needs to be tested through a scientific assessment. But regardless, we're going to need contrail management in the future, even when we decarbonize and say we move to hydrogen. So what we're doing today could be equally applied to a hydrogen aircraft of the future. And by that time, we should be even better at doing contrail management. So, yeah, it's going to be a long-term solution that we need for aviation.
Right. You've been now working within the industry for a decent amount of time. What gives you the most hope about the sustainable future of aviation?
I think it's a combination of what's happening in both Europe around the regulation and in America around technology development. So in Europe, the European Commission has taken some bold steps, actually rather sooner than expected, ratifying policy into legislation and releasing a tender to include this in the EU ETS, this non-CO2 impact from aviation. So that's a formal acknowledgement that the climate impact is actually much larger than just considering CO2 emissions. And aviation is quite unique as an industry because it's got this outsized forcing coming from things that are not CO2. In America, thanks to some of the decisions, the political decisions made around directing funding into climate mitigation, we had a recent call under the Department of Energy, which was seeking technology solutions, technology partnerships to form the embryos of solutions that will ultimately mitigate the problem. So I'm encouraged that we've got these two leading, they're different ends of the spectrum. Obviously in Europe, it's all about policy regulation, and ultimately that could lead to punitive regulation for the operators. However, if we're successful with our incentive, maybe it won't be required. And then in the States, they're already on the front foot. Well, let's try and solve the problem so we don't have to bring in that punitive regulation. We'll just solve the problem through technology. So that's very encouraging.
I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to see the headway you are making, not just with airlines, but also regulators. And the future indeed seems bright without the contrails in the sky. This has been extremely enlightening, Adam. I appreciate you sharing what you've done with Etihad and KLM. Now, the final part of this interview is a surprise. It's called the Rapid Fire Round, in which I ask you simple questions if you've heard of interviews on this podcast before. And you have to give me one-word answers. So simple things like, what's your favorite airline?
Ooh, that's a hard one. Very political. I have to say, we love all airlines.
Come on, don't try to be a politician here. Which airline would you fly if schedule or pricing was not an issue tomorrow?
I would fly two, in fact, in Europe, KLM, and in the Middle East, Etihad.
All right, you checked both the boxes there. I'm sure both of your stakeholders there will appreciate and love this interview. Let's go easy on you. What's your favorite book?
Ego is the enemy.
Oh, nice. Ryan Holiday.
Yeah, it's a brilliant collection of wise anecdotes.
Are you into Stoicism as well?
Not exactly.
Okay. That wasn't on the script of the questions, but I just had to ask since you mentioned a Ryan Holiday book. What's your favorite city, Adam?
It's probably going to be Catania in Sicily.
Wow, I have never been. I would now love to find out more.
In a previous life, I was a volcanologist, so traveling the world, climbing volcanoes, and there's a very famous volcano next to Catania called Etna that erupts frequently.
Mount Etna. Have you been to Montserrat?
I've not been to Montserrat. I've been to lots of North American, Central, and South American volcanoes nearby.
Did you do anything? Did you have anything to do with Eyjafjallajökull in Iceland, which disrupted aviation?
Absolutely. So that's actually what got me into working with aviation. So my PhD studies were on volcanic ash clouds and also ice nucleation. So what causes volcanic ash to settle out of volcanic clouds? It's largely driven by water ice forming on ash particles. I thought I'd got myself into a very niche dead end until Eyjafjallajökull erupted. And then I actually ended up working in a venture which was spun out of the Norwegian Institute for Air Research. The product was called Avoid. It was an ash camera for pilots. So we took thermal infrared sensing technology from satellites, put it on the wing of an aircraft, and worked alongside Airbus and EasyJet on that. And so that was really formative for me, inspirational, and led to me actually establishing SatAvia.
Wow, that is a very interesting story. I'm glad I asked you what's your favorite city. Interestingly, that Icelandic ash cloud, I think it was 2009, 2010 when it happened, was a critical defining moment for Simply Flying as well, because we came up with a social media crisis management manual for airlines after that on how do you deal with rebookings on Twitter and how do you inform lots of passengers whose flight is delayed and so that they don't have to call the call center. And it was a watershed moment because we ended up doing a lot of work on social media strategy and digital strategy following the Icelandic ash cloud.
Excellent.
In the early days. What's your favorite movie, Adam?
One of my favorite recent movies is Don't Look Up, which is a Netflix movie on the end of the world.
Highly relevant. You can change the entire thing from a comet hitting the Earth to climate change and it would work just fine.
Exactly.
What is something you still want to learn?
That's a good question. Possibly languages. I've always managed not to go beyond English, even though I've tried very hard. Maybe one day I'll have the time to put into languages.
चलिए फिर हम अगला इंटरव्यू हिंदी में करेंगे.
Thank you. No idea.
I just said let's do the next interview in Hindi.
Okay, brilliant.
I'm still waiting to do my first interview in Hindi or any other language for that matter. We'll get there. What do you do in your free time?
I do a lot of running.
Congratulations on the marathon. I just saw you finished the London Marathon this year.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was about an hour and 10 minutes slower than the last time I did it in 2010, when I was about 13 years younger. But I finished. We're trying to get...
Congratulations.
Yeah, so sailing is another pastime I really enjoy. It's great to get out in nature and just focus on activities like sailing, running, skiing.
Fantastic. You should come visit Whistler, where I am right now, for most of those things, actually. And final question, two more questions. Who do you look up to?
I've always looked up to famous people like Bill Gates and Elon Musk for his perseverance and huge successes. And Bill Gates is doing a lot of good for climate and climate mitigation.
Absolutely. And now the final question, what is the best advice you've received?
Be kind to people. From my wife.
As long as you're kind to your wife, I think it's a good start.
Absolutely. Yeah. The kindness goes a long way.
Indeed. Adam, thank you very much. The best one I've heard on that is be kind and not right. Every time you feel like you want to be right,
yeah,
try to be kind instead. So that's something I live by. Really good conversation from a former volcanologist turned... what do I call you now? A climate scientist working with aviation?
Call me an entrepreneur.
Entrepreneur is better. There you go. Now we're in the same boat. But Adam, really great hearing about your journey of building up, piloting, and now scaling up Satavia. And also, it was enlightening to know why we have to think beyond just carbon emissions when it comes to reducing the climate impact of aviation. Thanks for all the work you're doing and all the best.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pau is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.